Well, one of the things that was important at the conference, but we haven't picked it up in the program since, is see the play of noise, or think of turbulence as noise, nonlinear dynamics. And one, I just want to say, why is noise always colored in nonlinear dynamics? And then I'll let professionals take over. So the whole thing was worked out in 1810. What is it?
Are we not recording this one?
Apparently not.
So that's good.
That's good. We can stay with that.
I don't think the problem of turbulence was solved yesterday. They're forgotten. That's all right. It's fine. All the material is on there. We have a nice web page and lots of thoughts. So apparently native Ken Laplace worked it all out, and then because it has to do with Gaussians, you know, every periodically, and now it's speeding up, it's like every 2 weeks, somebody rediscovers it, because everybody discovers that you can do two Gaussians, and more than you get a Gaussian. So that's the essence of it. But, you know, the high points are Laplace's work, then Yaponov's postdoctoral dissertation, I mean, doctoral dissertation. That's remarkable because it's actually something that Yaponov did. Because usually, whenever you think of stability, we just stick the word Yaponov in front for reasons unknown to me. Physicists like the version of this called Ornstein-Uhlenbeck, and people with weather prediction and control, etc., like Kalman filters. But it's all the same thing. It's very simple. So the idea is super simple. And the question is, when you have noise and you have dynamics, you know, how does this noise evolve with time? So to define the terms, I do this for discrete time, but it's identical for continuous with some small bit. So this is the noise covariance at a given time. So instead of having deterministic trajectory as a point, you have a Gaussian distribution around it, and this is its covariance. Then you kick it by some noise, and that's, you know, we've learned a lot about it today, and that's the purpose of section today. And you evolve it deterministically for time t, and it gets deformed by Jacobian. So I just derived this formula, and then I'll figure out. But the main thing you have to understand about nonlinear dynamics and noise is that in nonlinear dynamics, noise is always colored, because it's a convolution of dynamics and, you know, something else that might or might not be colored. It might be white, but it doesn't really matter. Because in this convolution, dynamics always remembers its past, and if you think about it, also knows its future, and it's crucial in understanding what local noise looks like, effective noise or whatever you want to call it.
Who knows its future?
What do you say?
Noise knows its future?
Yeah. But, you know, that if I get to talk afterwards, but there's no chance I'll get to talk because 10 minutes is always in 30 and 1 hour here, and we only have 2 hours. So no choice, I come back. But anyway, the idea is very simple and easiest to illustrate in terms of equilibria. You know, I have a neighborhood of equilibrium that's described by some deterministic equations. Then you think what noise would do if there was no dynamics. And you think what, you know, dynamics would do if there was noise. And then you put them together. And that's good enough for the Garman work today. And basically what happens is you start someplace. Dynamics distorts the neighborhood that's given by the Jacobian and the deviation. And if you look at covariance, you look at expectation value of deviations from the center of the distribution, which is usually a deterministic trajectory. That's what covariance is. And now, you step later, these deviations get deformed, you know, and you get something in which covariance is sandwiched between Jacobian and its transpose. So that's what happens to the noise that you inherit. And then you give it a kick. You hit it. Now, covariances are wonderful because they add. And that's it. That's the covariance solution equation. And that's the whole thing, but then you can get plots out of it. Now, the simplest example is if you have a fixed point. That means that all multipliers of this stability matrix are smaller than 1 in magnitude. And that means no matter what you start with, you forget where you came from. Eventually, you get to the balance where the covariance is the previous covariance deformed plus the kick. That's called the Punov equation, and that's the Punov's thesis. And the simplest example is called Ornstein-Overbeck. So it turns out that this is a harmonic potential and noise. Two of them fight each other, and you end up with a Gaussian, which is the balance. The covariance is now the balance between the noise. See, contraction is very strong. Only thing you measure is noise. If contraction is almost 1, then you almost want to do a Brownian motion. You're in a very, you know, shallow harmonic potential. So that has the right behavior. And I'm out of here. Good. You take over. So that's the, you know, basic idea. The noise is always color. And it has a very simple evolution law, at least on a level of second order variances.
Okay, so hello, I'm good. Thanks for being here. And I'd like to thank actually Bracken for setting up this session. It's always great to be back to Santa Barbara. I was here at the conference a few weeks ago, and I see the significant overlap actually between attendees in my talk and here. I'm not going to tell you anything new, so I'll try to summarize in 10, 15 minutes essentially what I told you a few weeks ago and try to provide a big picture overview of what we mean by color. So as Predrag mentioned, noise, or let's say in the context of turbulence, velocity fluctuations are always color. However, what I'm going to try to argue today is if you try to capture statistics of velocity fluctuations, let's say in fully turbulent flows, by models that are convenient for analysis, for optimization and control, you also need to color statistics of stochastic excitation sources into these low complexity models that get into the consumer. So color in the sense of we need to shape up our spectrum of stochastic excitation sources to the equations that I'm going to introduce in a moment. So I'll be looking essentially at a class of stochastically driven linearized models. So A is here a dynamical generator that is obtained by linearizing Navier-Stokes equations around a turbulent mean velocity profile, averaged velocity profile. And I'm going to add one additional source of excitation that I'm going to try to shape in order to completely capture second order statistics of fully turbulent flows. Right? So the question that I'm going to ask is essentially whether I can combine physics-based modeling that comes from Navier-Stokes equations and where approximation is made at the level of linearizing Navier-Stokes equations around turbulent mean velocity profile and neglecting second order terms in velocity fluctuations, whether I could shape statistics of stochastic forcing so that I'm statistically consistent at the level of second order statistics with whatever full-blown turbulent flows are doing. So essentially, I want to augment utility of physics-based models using data so that I am statistically consistent with whatever full-blown turbulent flows are doing. And, you know, again, the reason why we want to use linearized equations, there is a rich history on the topic. You know, people have been showing for the last probably quarter century utility of linearized equations in both transitional and turbulent flows, and it's, you know, really a topic that somehow goes way beyond the amount of time you can allow to speak here today. So essentially what you want to do, you want to somehow capture the role of nonlinearity by looking at stochastically forced linearization around turbulent mean flow. From system theoretic point of view, Navier-Stokes equations can be exactly represented actually in terms of this block diagram. If you express dynamics of velocity fluctuations up to first order fluctuations, there is this, you know, inertial nonlinear term that couples back into linearized equations, right? And many people, again, have studied the upper part of this feedback rule in the last 20 to 25 years, and that's very well understood. It's very well understood how much feature we can extract actually from the linearized equations in both transitional and turbulent flows at the level of extracting, let's say, coherent structures. And let's say Javier has opened the area of using having this causality augmented linearized version of Navier-Stokes equations to show that if you study linearized equations at high enough Reynolds number, that you capture channel-wide and near-wall streaks and things of that sort. The question that I want to ask today is, can I go a step beyond this? Can I shape the spectrum of the forcing to linearized equations so that I exactly recover statistics of Navier-Stokes equations? And the answer is that yes, actually, you can do that. As far as the equivalence at the level of second-order statistics is concerned, you can capture the role of nonlinearity by a linear state feedback, where essentially if you think of this dynamical generator A being given by linearization around turbulent mean velocity profile, and if we want to stick with the assumption of having white noise as a source of stochastic excitation, you need to provide one additional state feedback term that is going to allow us actually to capture the role of nonlinearity. And I'll tell you actually how we arrived at this.
So you have nonlinearity, and you mentioned feedback, but not into the mean flow. You're not going to change anything.
No. This is not my objective. Right, so you're asking a different question. What I'm asking here, can I provide Reynolds stresses so that I bring these Reynolds stresses back to the mean flow equations? And Navid is going to talk more about this. He's going to talk actually about how to couple stochastic and force linearized equations with certain restricted versions of nonlinear equations for me, the only purpose of the discussion today is how to capture, let's say, Reynolds stresses by stochastic and general linearity. So, Predrag already introduced a topic in the context of discrete time systems. In continuous time, an equivalent of this steady state Lyapunov equation that he wrote is given here. So, and this equation should be interpreted in the following way. If I give you a model of your system, if you have dynamical generator, and if you know how disturbances enter into your evolution equation, if you know an equivalent of his matrix delta, right? W for me is spatial correlation, let's say, of white in time stochastic excitation to the linearized equations, you can compute steady state covariance sex as a solution of this Lyapunov equation. This is a steady state limit of what he wrote in discrete time. If you want to propagate this in time, you need to add derivative of x with respect to time as well. This all holds under the assumption that A is a stable dynamical generator. It turns out, fortunately, that in turbulent flows that we're interested in, involve bounded shear flows, if you linearize around turbulent mean velocity profile, you're going to end up with a stable evolution. So the way people typically use the Lyapunov equation is, I give you a model, matrices A and B, or operators A and B, I give you a spatial correlation of your white in time stochastic excitation, and you compute covariance operator or covariance matrix of your velocity fluctuations in statistical steady state. I want to ask a converse question. I want to ask a question, if you give me x, can I shape the right-hand side so that I'm statistically consistent with whatever x is given to me by experimentalists or perhaps by people that run mirrors? Or if you give me portions of x, what does it take to shape the spectrum of stochastic excitation so that I recover parts of x that I don't know and I exactly reproduce portions of x that I know, right? So the challenge here is that this is fundamental fact of linear algebra. If I give you an arbitrary positive semi-definite matrix, this linear operator on the left-hand side does not necessarily need to be positive negative semi-definite, right? And it's very easy to construct examples that, you know, essentially for given operator A, if I give you arbitrary positive semi-definite matrix, right-hand side does not need to be positive semi-definite, which essentially means that you're not going to be able to reproduce given statistics by stochastically forced linear excitations with widely timed stochastic excitation, right? And it turns out actually that in thermal channel flow, this indeed happens. Wideness in time restriction is too narrow. So about 15 years ago, a colleague of mine, Trifon Giorgio, provided a very nice algebraic characterization in the case when noise to the linearized equations is called, right? So what he showed is that all you need to do is to modify the right-hand side of this equation. Covariance operator X still has to be positive semi-definite, but you no longer require actually positive semi-definiteness of the right-hand side. 5 minutes.
So no, I have a question.
How much time do I have, by the way? Yeah.
Well, in theory, 10 minutes, but you're doing
but
it.
But I'm sending it for a sound, right? So, yeah. Okay. Please.
But that,
please.
That's on top of my questions, probably.
Sure.
And that's on top of Denise's question. So.
Sorry, are you taping her? Please don't.
No.
Because then she's going to be politically correct.
So.
She's already taped.
No, you can actually slow down. Nothing is on record here. I can say whatever I want.
So you're talking about white in time here. Is there an analogous sort of coloring in space that's important here? Or is only time important in this, like only the coloring in time important in the context of this problem?
So in this context, I'm talking about coloring time. So if you take a look at what is happening here, W can provide information about spatial correlations.
Right, so you right? could have, you have W colored in space as well.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right? I mean, if you, but see, it turns out that, you know, even if I allow you to have cross correlations, let's say different distances in the ball normal direction, this is not going to be able to rescue you. Right, so even if you depart actually from whiteness in time in ball normal direction, for example, in channel flow, this can't come to your rescue. Right, but you're right. I mean, coloring time is what I have in mind here. Right? If you want to depart from whiteness and time restriction, you need to look at this algebraic relation, and this operator H or matrix H has an interesting physical interpretation. It's related to a cross correlation between state of the system and disturbance. If disturbances are white in time, there is no cross correlation between them. This drops, so you recover standard Lyapunov equation that Prandtl introduced, right? But this gives you additional degrees of freedom in your problem, right? And then if you have information about age, it turns out that, you know, you can provide interesting parameterization and do things that we represent anymore. So let's go back to fluids, and, you know, we've done this a while ago. We used essentially direct numerical simulations in the channel flow to compute steady-state solution of Navier-Stokes equations, a particular pair of Kx and Kz, and if you plug it into left-hand side of the Lyapunov equation, it turns out that it is sign indefinite. So whiteness in time restriction is too strong. You need to depart from whiteness in time in order to be able to exactly reproduce covariance matrix of velocity fluctuations that comes out of nonlinear simulations of Navier-Stokes equations, right? So the key result is here, and again, it's due to Trifon Giorgio. It was published in Controls Community. Nobody really was paying attention to this up until I told him, you know, about things that I was excited about. So this essentially answers what it takes to do things with coloring time excitations. So theorem goes like this. If you give me an arbitrary positive semi-definite matrix, and you give me a model of my system, the dynamical generator A and input matrix B, then X qualifies to be a steady state covariance of your stochastically driven linear system if and only if you can solve this linear equation for H. Right? So I give you A and B, I give you X. If you can solve this linear equation for H, then the answer is yes, you can reproduce positive semi-definite matrix with stochastically driven linear model. There, perhaps you need to have colored in time excitation in order to do that. And interestingly enough, again, there is an equivalent rank condition, and this is pretty insightful. So it tells you essentially that there is a solution to this equation if and only if ranks of these two matrices here are equal to each other. So I'd like to draw to your attention the fact that if B is a full rank matrix, if you allow, let's say, excitation or your linearized equations everywhere throughout your domain, then you can reproduce whatever you want to. any given covariance qualifies to be steady state covariance of stochastically driven linear system. So rank of B, or number of input channels to which you introduce stochastic source of excitation, becomes an important parameter. Okay. And this also points to dangers that you run into. And I highlighted these dangers a few slides down the road. But let me tell you what we do with this. Imagine that I have my covariance matrix X and I have model A. What we have shown is that there is a parameterization of the linear filter that colors white in time stochastic excitation of the linear filter and gives you colored in time force into the linearized equations, where, let's say, model of your system, right, these matrices A and B, are obtained, used actually to obtain parameters of the filter, and inverse of the covariance also enters into the mix, right? So you don't need to go into details here, but the bottom line is that we have an explicit parameterization of the filter. It's a dynamical system of the same order as your linearized Navier-Stokes equations. It has as many degrees of freedom as linearized Navier-Stokes equations, and you have this cascade connection that you can study, analyze, simulate, and do whatever you want to. Please.
I just want to be clear about the logic. So if we go back to the previous slide, yes, you're saying that if that A, B, yes, correlated to X, if I can find H, yes, then I can match.
No.
I then, do you solve for H, and then?
You do, you do. Now I'm not giving you details. I'm skipping details. Imagine that you solve, that somehow you came up with H,
yes,
right? You came up with H, right? Then you get X that comes out. Take a look at this. You have X that comes out of nonlinear simulations. You have already model of your system. You know where B enters. You have H, so you construct, yep, essentially model. Interestingly enough, this matrix B is the same one as in your linearized equations, and these matrices AF and CF, you have essentially augmentation of your linear dynamical generator by this combination where CF depends on H, X,
yeah,
statistics of white excitation and B in this way. Excellent point. Right? We solve an optimization problem that I'm going to spell out in a moment, but it, I skip details.
In principle, that's what you would do. I mean, you could do anyway.
Yes.
Once you know H, then your system is determined.
Exactly. It's determined. This is one particular parameterization. There are others.
Sure.
Right? So, but interestingly enough, actually, this cascade connection has additional features. It turns out, actually, that this cascade connection can be represented by a equivalent representation that has as many degrees of freedom as spatially discretized linearized Navier-Stokes equations. The reason being that you have cascade connection of two systems, two stable systems, where the disturbances into these two systems enter through the same matrix B. So in controls terminology, this is an uncontrollable system. So there are internal modes that get canceled out, and they don't contribute to the input-output mapping from this white source of excitation to the quantity that you care about. And the equivalent representation is given by this modification of your linear dynamical generator, where essentially these matrices B and CF account for the mismatch that you have because of the fact that you neglect the nonlinear interactions.
You know, one bad story, yes, remember what C is.
C is, let's say, in X's evolution model, all normal velocity vorticity, so divergence free condition has been eliminated, and C is a matrix that establishes kinematic relation between all normal velocity vorticity and velocity fluctuations, right? It's just spatial differential operator. CF is an object that we construct based on data, right? And this matrix H that we have covered, right? So what are the challenges here? Okay, let me tell you what dangers are here. If you allow matrix B to be, let's say, full rank or identity matrix, right? And I'll come back to this. Imagine that B is full rank, that you excite all degrees of freedom in the linearized Navier-Stokes equations, right? B identity, it means that you can choose H to be given by a product of A and X, right? And if you take a look at this equivalent representation, CF is now given by this expression. So A plus CF turns out to be equal to minus 1/2 X inverse. You can actually reproduce statistics of full-blown Navier-Stokes equations by an equivalent system that completely cancels the physics of the original linearized Navier-Stokes equations. Right? You're exciting all degrees of freedom in your model, and you're allowing colloid processes as your excitation, gives you too many degrees of freedom, in a sense. You can completely cancel physics and reproduce whatever you want to. Right? How can you see that this is true? If you go back to this Lyapunov equation, right? If I give you B identity, W identity, right? And A being equal minus 1/2 X inverse, this obviously satisfies this equation, right? And this is a consequence of the fact that you are allowing excitations in every single input channel. So you want to avoid this. You want to essentially avoid the fact that you want to force equations as through as little input channels as you can, in a sense, so that you keep essential features of your physics and yet reproduce statistics that full blown or non-linear equations give you. And this is exactly what we've done by formulating certain optimization problems and running out of time. These optimization problems, you know, allow you to essentially match partially available statistics under the hypothesis that you generated covariance by stochastically driven linearized equations, and you know there are some terms that I introduce here to promote small number of input channels in our B matrix. I'm not going to go into details, but let me come back and you know go to this question that somebody asked a while back, right? So if you take a look at you know, Navid is going to talk more about this. If you take a look at really what turbulence models are supposed to do for you, they're supposed to give you second order statistics so that you drive, let's say, Reynolds average Navier-Stokes equations and obtain turbulent mean velocity profile. There is a zoology of these different turbulent models. Perhaps one way to look at this, and again, you're going to hear way more about this later, is to use data to essentially get statistics out of linearized equations, right? And this will be a data-driven, and this is speculation, we haven't tried this, but it will be a data-driven, essentially, class of turbulence closure models that can perhaps have some utility. Navid is going to show you, actually, that if you don't use Reynolds average Navier-Stokes equations, but you use restricted nonlinear characterization in terms of streamwise constant nonlinear model, and you use stochastically driven linearized equations with only Viking time stochastic excitation source, then this is already going to give you some interesting features. So whatever I told you here has been summarized in you know transactions on automatic control, and this is hot off press, just appeared in JFM, so I'll stop here.
Links on our wiki if you're
Everything is online. Brandon was kind enough actually to provide links to all of these papers. Again, sorry for rushing through this. I'm sure there are tons of questions, but I'll be here to answer any questions you may have.
Can we ask questions? All right. It's good.
Brandon, can he ask questions?
Anna, can you?
Everybody looks at you.
And you explain this also in the conference, so you have this optimization procedure.
Sure.
I don't understand the details, but well, I mean, there's this issue of rank, and then there's the issue of something really being rank deficit, and then there are things that are not, I mean, they're essentially, I mean, for all moral purposes, they're highly rank deficit because of the nature of these linearized operators.
Sure.
So the optimization procedure you use will essentially lock onto that. That is to say, we know that forcing the driving that those the eddy interaction, whatever you want to call it, will only excite certain things through the resolvers.
That's what we want to identify. I mean, the rank deficiency that you're referring to relates to essentially if you study input-output properties, let's say just of linearized equations, there are few directions that are most amplified by linearized dynamics. Right? What I'm saying here is that I don't want to tickle my linearized dynamics too much. I want to restrict where I excite it. Think of boundary layer problem, right? And you can excite everywhere throughout the boundary layer. This gives you way too many degrees of freedom. Right. If you depart from whiteness and time restriction, right? So what I want to do, I want to essentially identify the spatial region where I should force so that I don't tickle my...
So my question was, so your optimization procedure will precisely do this, is that
exactly, but it's not very easy to interpret just, hey, you should force here, because at the end of the day, you know, what you're doing, you're modifying the dynamical generator. So, but you can study now input-output properties of this and repeat analysis that Beverly has advanced in the context of resolvent analysis. And indeed, it turns out that even this modified characterization, you know, representation has low rank and so on. But your point is exactly correct. We are essentially providing B, which is of low rank, through our optimization. Convex optimization, by the way, doesn't get stuck. Any other questions? Brother, are you tweeting in real time? Or?
Secretary wants me to come immediately to her office. I'm telling I can because we have her speaking. There are limits to what organizers can be subjected to. Anyway, you know, this is totally freestyle. I mean, whatever you want to do, but you know, Navid and Birgit should also say something. That's
okay.
Navid,
So thanks, and thanks, Patrak, for organizing this. I don't know, I think I already promised too much for my talk. So Patrak asked me to give a short intro of what we do, and I really tried to be short, so let's see how it goes. So so the problem we're trying to address is how large-scale structures are form and maintain interpreted flows, and here I give examples of geophysical flows where we see large-scale structures form which have a particular length scale and particular structure, but a similar type of phenomena arises in one-bounded flows, in boundary layers, and so on. And I'll try to give you a general idea of the methods and the framework we are using to address this kind of problem. So the problem we're trying to address is how this, for example, how these particular structures are formed and maintained, and perhaps even more ambitiously, understand in general the mechanism of how turbulence works. My claim is that regarding large-scale structure formation, that the essential dynamics lies in the interaction of the mean flows and the turbulence and the eddy field, and the structure formation has an analytic expression only if you study the statistical state dynamics, that is the dynamics that governs the statistics of the flow, rather than Navier-Stokes dynamics, Navier-Stokes single flow realization dynamics. And because of my first claim, a second order closure is enough. to study this. That these are my claims, and I'll try to explain what statistical state dynamics is and make the connection with what Mihail was saying. So think of abstractly, this will be your single realization dynamics. This will be, I've written down here abstractly the equation of motions. These are my Navier-Stokes equations, or my barotropic vorticity equation, or my quasi-geostrophic multilayer equation, or my primitive equations in the oceans, whatever your setting is. And I've added some additive noise on the right-hand side, and I was hoping here that Bassam would have already convinced you before me that noise is the natural thing to add there, because noise is it's everywhere. I mean, you have noise from external excitations, you have noise from dynamics you haven't included in F already. So it's I mean, adding noise is not something that should sound very peculiar to everybody. Now, these equations are usually, most of the times, non-linear. Adding the noise makes them stochastic, and they are analytically intractable. So the way to study and to understand this is to, it's not to study the dynamics that these equations gather, but the dynamics that the statistics of these equations are governed. And how do we do that? We take our flow fields and we split them into a mean and an eddy. And for the moment being, think of mean being just an average, an abstract average, not a time mean, because I want to study the evolution of my mean and my eddy flows and my eddy fields. But I'll define what my mean is in the end, and after you split your field, you can construct the whole hierarchy of same time statistical moments. So these statistical moments have time dependence, and your first statistical moment is your mean flow, is these large scale structures, for example. Then you have your second statistical moment, which is the covariance, which is what Mihailo was talking about. The covariance. You have your third statistical moment, and so on and so on. And then you can go back to the equation of motions and find out how each of these statistical moments evolve. And the first the equation for the first moment will involve the first and the second. The equation of the second moment will involve the first and the second and the third, and also there will be the correlation of the noise there. And the noise will only come into that equation because I take the noise to be Gaussian. So there's no third moment of the noise. All the noise properties are described by its second cumulant. And you have an evolution from the third statistical moment, and so on and so on. Now, I was claiming that second order closure is adequate, so I will do that, and I will neglect everything from third order and above, or think of everything from third order and above being part of the noise. Parameterize them as part of the noise that already exists there, and thus I get my what I call S3T, or what people have called the cumulant expansion of second order, or second order closure. And it's an evolution equation for the first two statistical moments of the flow. And I think here I have it, okay, and I rewrote it as this, in this form. And you can recognize that the second moment is exactly the time-dependent Lyapunov equation that Petrak was showing and Mihail was showing, and it's in a different form. Here, Q is what I think Mihail had, a delta, and C is what I don't even remember what was Petrak's notation.
The main thing is that A is A. That's the good.
Yeah, A is A. So, and what's to note here is that I haven't taken the first moment or my mean flow to be zero, as usually was done in homogeneous isotropic turbulence studies. If I had done that, then my A operator would just be dissipation. And it's this interaction of my mean flow, which it's the C1, with the second cumulant that colors the noise. So if I haven't done that, if I had taken C1 to be zero, then I put white noise in Q, white noise would come out. So I will have just the homogeneous eddy statistics. But the interaction of the mean flow with the second order eddy statistics through the noise brings out structure. And mean flows may develop, and the second order statistics may become inhomogeneous and depart from homogeneous statistics. So this system is again nonlinear. It's not stochastic because I've taken the covariances, and so it's autonomous. It's analytically tractable, but you know, we can't get everything and not lose anything. The disadvantage is that it's of much higher dimensionality, because my variables now, it's not the flow fields, but the statistics of the flow fields. So what can we do with this system is we can find fixed equilibria. We can find equilibria of the first and second moments. And this equilibria may be fixed points, maybe periodic orbits. And they correspond to equilibria of the statistical state dynamics, which if you go back to the original flow, they correspond to turbulent statistical equilibrium of the flow dynamics. Now, we can study the stability of this turbulent equilibria, and thus predict bifurcations from one flow regime to a different flow regime. And most importantly, we can analytically investigate the mechanism by which this flow up to this second order closure, the turbulence works. Now, let me connect with what Mihailo was doing. Mihailo was not evolving the mean flow. He was saying, okay, take the mean flow profile. Somebody gives me the mean flow profile. And he was asking, if I put white noise there here and solve this as steady state, I won't get my actual second order statistics. He was saying, okay, what kind of noise should I put there to get the second order statistics? Now, here I do something, this is something different. I let the mean flow evolve, and I put white noise there, and the mean flow colors the noise and colors the second order statistics and brings out and goes to steady state with a mean flow and the second order statistics that are accompanied. So that's, I don't know if I'm
it's like a characterization. I fix in time mean flow. For me there is a mean flow as well, but as you pointed out, it's no time evolving.
Somebody gives you, God gives you the mean flow, and then...
No, God.
Okay. So might be the devil, it might be the Lord, but you got to serve.
Yes. So what's... of course.
But once you reach this, if your mean flow satisfies first equation, so you had zero on the left-hand side.
Yeah.
Then how can you get, how can you match, he just told us you can't match the statistics with white noise, so how can you?
Wait.
But his equations are not the same as his equations.
I thought the first equation is the same. If the mean flow that God gives us satisfies the first equation.
Yeah, but. God or Javier will give you the second order statistics also,
yeah.
And it will satisfy. So yes, if you get the mean flow profile from the DNS of Javier and the second order statistics, this equation will be satisfied. That's step 7, right? Yes. So
I will still have it. So what will appear in the second equation is exactly the same mean flow that we had before.
Yes, but. Mihailo's operator here were linearized operators. I don't linearize about anything.
Well, Oh, it's not linearized?
No, it's not. It's not. These are not my linearized Navier-Stokes equations. It's my Navier. It's everything. Everything is here. What the only thing I've done is that I've neglected third-order cumulants.
But that's not true. That equation is equivalent to a linearized operator among about the current state of the mean flow.
Yeah, okay.
So this is not nonlinear.
Okay, you're asking.
If equation one saturates at the mean flow that God gave us,
yes.
And equation two has to be the same equation we have had before.
Yes.
So we just heard if you put white noise in, you can't get the right second order.
His notion of mean flow is different. So,
right.
So if you take a look at what is the
point, again, I don't know what Benis has done, but what Brian, Petros, and Benis have been advancing. The first equation is the equation for streamwise constant nonlinear Navier-Stokes equations, which gives you a velocity profile, which is a function of one normal coordinate, of spinwise coordinate, and of time. So if you take a look at the properties of this operator A, it's dramatically different operator relative to what I looked at. The operator that I look at linearizes equations around low normal dependent thing. But you're raising an important point, though. I mean, point that he's raising is a fundamental question, though. I mean, how can you guarantee, actually, that that this is consistent in statistical steady state? I mean, is there a
okay, there is a question here that, okay, I evolve this system and it will go to a steady state. Will it give me the same statistics as the DNS? That's not obvious.
I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about he just told us it wouldn't happen.
No, but it is a different mean flow in this.
Yeah, I'm bothered by
but
that.
But the U prime is a different U prime. So it's Mihailo's mean is a function of Y only. So you're getting it. So in some sense, you're coloring the noise. Like if you were to take this and partition it into the part which is Mihailo's part and the part, it's going to be a little bit different because one of it is his mean is only a function of y.
I mean, it's completely different.
So when you say when you say mean, you mean string wise, span wise, and time average means.
Right.
Yeah.
No, but there's no time in this. Once you go to steady state, that's why I'm confused. Once equation one saturates at some, suppose you found a mean.
At some steady state, then you also have the second order statistics. So what Mihailo's doing is taking a system that hasn't evolved in time and finding the statistics from it. Here, this is a dynamical equation that you're in some sense simulating. It's different.
No, but he's making a very valid point.
Yeah,
he's raising a point of if this goes to statistical steady state,
exactly.
Your mean, your first moment is going to be a function of all normal and spinwise score.
Exactly.
It's not going to be a function only of y as it is for me.
Okay.
So what guarantees that in statistical steady state, this is a consistent system when you only have QAB in the mix?
Okay. And when you are asking this, you are thinking of a channel flow, I guess.
No, all I'm trying to do is understand the relationship between what we heard just before and what we're hearing
different,
now.
Different profile.
Different mean flow.
CA1 for him is different object than I use to analyze.
Yeah, the states are different here, too. The states are different here. The state is a covariance where his state is you.
But
your fundamental question, the answer to your fundamental question, as I understand it, is there isn't
his
one.
His question.
Well, the fundamental question as you, between the two of you, you pose, I don't think that we have a precise answer to, like we don't have a proof that it should be. I mean, unless you have something that I've not seen, there's no proof. It's a conjecture.
Which means what exactly? I mean, what is your conjecture? That there is a steady state? Or?
That the steady state is right, essentially.
No.
The steady state.
No. Well,
I mean, if there is a fixed point, you have a fixed point. It might not look like a channel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's my point, is the conjecture is the steady state does look like a channel. That's the conjecture.
The mean flow looks like a channel.
Right.
Not the second order statistics.
So that's the difference.
Yeah. The second order statistics, they're not by necessity. You might find some settings that they are, but in general, what we see is that the mean flow looks pretty well, but the second order statistics are not always.
Okay. Okay. For a given Q, you're fixing Q.
Yeah. For a given Q, If I then try and play and find, but I can't.
So I see. So God, you're kind of his profile, and he'll determine Q. And then if you're not God, you're a different Q, then you can solve and get back to the original mean flow.
You're
trying to find Q so that it looks like exactly.
That's right.
Excellent question.
Okay, so what else I was going to say? Okay, so let me make one more comment, and I'm done. So all this was abstract. Okay, so when we want to relate this with actual Navier-Stokes or the actual single flow realization dynamics that we have to define what this means that we said. I'll decompose my flow into a mean and an eddy. What this mean actually means, okay? And the definition of the mean will come from each problem and from each setting that we have and from each phenomenon that we're trying to address. And if we define a mean that happens to be ergodic, that happens to be that ensemble average over different forcing realizations is equivalent to our mean, or if we define a mean, let me say it the other way, so that the system has the opportunity to go sample the whole phase space, then we will expect that the predictions of this system will be realizable to the actual single flow dynamics. And let me give you an example. So if I have Jupiter and I want to study the Jovian winds, it is more than natural to define my mean as an average along latitude circles. And if I have Jupiter, then if I go at 45 degrees, I know that the circumference of the Jupiter is around 300,000 kilometers. And the forcing is Jupiter is a convection that comes from the interior of the planet, and it comes out as this vortices or storms that's apparent all over the place in Jupiter, and they have a forcing scale of 1,000 kilometers. So I expect that around the latitude circle I have around 300 forcing realizations. So this should be pretty much ergodic, and I will expect it to work, and indeed it does. If I compare observations with predictions of a system similar to what I was describing, it worked pretty well. And but again, I'm saying that every time what my mean is, it should come from what the problem and what the phenomena I'm trying to address is. So this is all I had to say. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so I would like to tell you a little bit about some work that I've been doing with my students and collaborators, you know, over the last few years about noise and turbulence. And what I'll be telling you about mostly today is the work of my student, John Kaminsky. He wasn't able to come today because he had to work in MATLAB, but you've probably seen him around. And then we used the data that was collected by Greg Buley, who's now at Cornell, but he was working in Göttingen, you know, on the variable density wind tunnel there. And his student was Michael Schinnberg, who is now at Stanford. Here's an outline, and don't be afraid, you know, I won't be talking about all of this. It turns out you can use these methods to look at the roughness and space of the solutions, but I won't mention that unless you ask me. So I'm mostly be talking just about the first part here, the stochastic closure of the Navier-Stokes equation, and how you can use that to get the commander of Oppenhoff theory, the Schiller back intermittency exponents. And then we'll compare with the data from the variable density wind tunnel from Göttingen. So we start with the Reynolds decomposition, and the idea is to split the flow into a large scale and small scale flow, as you all are very familiar with, but that will introduce, of course, the at least costing term in the large scale flow. And the idea is to use stochastic closure to close that problem. And it was pointed out to me recently that adding the noise to the Navier-Stokes equation is not exactly a new idea. If you look in the book by Landau and Lipschitz, and they argue, that was written in 59, I believe, they argue that if you look at fully developed turbulence, you really should be solving a stochastic Navier-Stokes. And they write down what the noise should be. They make it both light in time and space. In the 60s, shortly after, it was realized that that couldn't be true, because if it's white in space, then the fluid velocity wouldn't be continuous in space. If you're in two dimensions, it's barely continuous. In three dimensions, it's a distribution. So that can't be true. You have to pull some restrictions of the noise, but, you know, we're basically going to use the same argument as they used to try to figure out what the noise looks like. So we have a large scale flow, and then we have the small scale flow. And this is a noisy environment, so we can add some noise. And the question is, what should the form of the noise be? And there have been a lot of attempts to linearize about profiles and then figure out how the instabilities magnify the ambient noise, which is white, and color it. And I've read a lot of these papers, and it seems that after a while, the noise forgets where it comes from. And you seem to get a generic kind of noise. So one might try a different approach and just ask, if there is generic noise in the equation, what does it have to look like? And this is what it has to look like. And the argument is pretty simple. You know, I've written the Navier-Stokes equation as a, you know, for the small scale flow. So you have some influence of the large scale flow, obviously, the small scale flow. But I've written it as a stochastic PDE. And there are three noise terms. Two of them are additive, and one of them is multiplicative. And one thing that, you know, you might want to come away with from this talk, if nothing else, is that it's not enough just to have additive noise.
So why do you choose to only have the small scale as a multiplier that this multiplicative term isn't influenced by the large scales?
Well, you know, if you do the I should address that. I mean, basically that's because I'm looking at this term here.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm thinking that, you know, you have the most singular structures in turbulence, you know, which presumably are vortex lines, so close to vortex lines. And associated with those most singular structures, there's probably just noise in the grating. And that is going to be multiplied by the, you know, the small scale noise for sure. So the multiplicative noise, and I'm kind of jumping ahead here, ends up being simply the small scale times jumps. So I'm using this to look at the noise or model the noise that would come from those two terms. Yeah.
I could keep those terms also, right? It's not that you replace those terms with these three stochastic processes.
I replace which term? I obviously keep all the deterministic terms, absolutely.
You just add.
I add the
noise, and you ask the question, which is the best noise to add, and you figure out that it's these three.
Yeah, you have to make an argument.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And what's the argument? The argument is the same as you will find in the book by, you know, Landau and Sitchin. You take your box, let's say that you have a box with periodic boundary conditions, you split it into little boxes. You don't know what the dissipation process is in each box, but you assume that they're neatly coupled, and then you apply the central limit theorem. And the central limit theorem tells you that you have to look in all directions in Fourier space. So these are Fourier components, but your noise is going to be you're basically going to get a Brownian motion driving the noise in all of those different directions. And these are just independent Brownian motions, and I'm taking the derivative of the Brownian motion. So basically we're saying the noise is wind in time. Yeah.
So the first line here is the full number of Stokes, basically.
Yes.
And then you're adding noise. So are you saying that your coarse graining is that why the noise comes?
Well, you can look at it that way, but you can also just think about it, you know, from the point of view of Landau and Sitchin, which was fully developed turbulence. You know, your fluid particles are moving through very noisy environments in trying to model turbulence.
Okay. So
now, how? Yeah.
So the first process I can see is a white noise process. The
right.
Second process, though, is proportional to dt. So is it a noise process?
Good question. Where does that come from? It comes from Kramer's theorem, or the large deviation principle.
Ah.
Namely, because you know, okay, so you modeled your mean field, you know, your mean noise field by this Fourier, you know, this Fourier series. You also know that there are going to be large discussions of meetings. How do you model that? Well, you estimate them by the large deviation principle or Kramer's theorem, and that's where this term comes.
Okay.
You also assume that since this is a description of one mean field, that they should scale in the same way. You have to make some assumptions. Here you basically don't have to make any assumptions. Any process would have to, you know, approach the Brownian motion in the limit. For this one, you have to make some assumptions. You have to assume that your processes, you know, need to box are for some processes. But if you do, you can work out what the estimate is for the large deviation principle, and that's what it ends up being. Now, and then, that's the additive noise. And then, as we mentioned before, you know that there are going to be some singularities. You expect some near jumps in the gradient, and you try to model the noise associated with that as jump noise, which is simply multiplicative noise, you know, with a finite, possibly very large number of jumps.
We got lots of different letters there, so what's H and what's M bar and, you know. Well, some feeling. I just.
Yeah, so K is just the Fourier transform, you know, variable. This is just the derivative of the Brownian motion. There are independent Brownian motions for each Fourier component. These are just the Fourier components. H is the size of the jump, and N is the number of the jump associated with each Fourier variable. So it's a jump process. There's a number of jumps, and there's the size of it.
And you prescribe the distribution HK.
Yeah. This is basically, this is Levy noise.
Levy flights.
Yeah. Well, not Levy flights necessarily, but Levy jumps, Levy noise. So, you know, it's a little more general than Brownian motion. I mean, this is the continuous part, this is the discrete part, the jump part. They both have to be there. So, okay, let's assume that we believe that this is the noise. What can we do with it? Of course, you also realize that we have infinitely many coefficients, and we don't know what they are. We have to make some assumptions about them, you know, so that the series actually converges. And this is what was missing in the Landau-Lipschitz argument. You have to assume these Fourier series, they converge, and they converge in such a way that the dissipation rate makes sense. Otherwise, you would never converge theory. And what that means mathematically is that the gradient has to, of U has to make sense as an L2 function. That's what it means. Okay. Now, what do we get out of it? Well, we get the 1962 Kolmogorov and Opohov theory. I mean, this was the theory. They improved on the 41 theory by putting dissipation rate in there and taking the ensemble average. And that gave them scaling exponents of the structure functions. These are the structure functions, so you're taking velocity differences at two points in fluid. And they have to scale with a Lag variable with these exponents equal to the p, and these are the this was the 41 theory. These are the intermittency corrections. Now, Kolmogorov thought that they were log normal. That turned out to be inconsistent with experiments, and finally in the 90s. Shooting the back, they showed that they are, in fact, log normal. They're, in fact, log Poissonian. And they got the intermittency corrections that seem to be in agreement with experiments and DNS. How can you get this? Well, here is the color. And this is why, you know, this fit fits into our discussion. The noise that we wrote down is almost not colored. It's slightly colored in space because of this color, but it's not colored in time. So what colors it? It's the Navier-Stokes evolution that colors it. I will color the noise. And basically, what's going to happen is that you're going to get, well, you know, what I've done here is that I've used some tricks from probability theory. I used the Feynman-Katz formula, and I've used Kirsanov theorem. But the point is that we can take a small-scale equation, and we can write it as an integral equation. And then we can make that integral equation, see what the information it gives us. And a prominent role is played by this operator. This operator actually comes from linearizing the pressure. And it turns out that if you keep the pressure in there and you linearize it, you get an operator that you can deal with, and it's much easier to deal with than the term coming from the inertial terms. And in fact, that seems to be put into this martingale. The inertial terms are simply put into this martingale by this sound theory. So with that expression, we can compute this. And assuming that we have some estimates on the spectrum of this, operator in Abitibi. So we can compute the exponents and write this to theory. You know, black and X's and dots are DNS and experiments. But you see there's a very good agreement between the theory and the exponents. What happens is that the Feynman-Katz formula gives you the log Poisson processes. Surely that they discovered that associated with the exponents, the stochastic processes, log Poisson processes. And you see that the jump term gives you immediately from the Navier-Stokes equation the log Poisson processes. That's a computation which I won't show you. And you get the agreement with the experiments. But you get much more, and this is what Young was doing in this thesis. You can compute all the structural functions, and you can also compute them as, you can compute how they depend on the Reynolds number. That's crucial. So these are the terms which are basically, you know, the intermittency correction in here comes from the log Poisson processes. But then these are the higher order terms which come from the estimate of the spectrum of the operator K. And this is the first structure function, you know, comes in with the right exponent. This is the, which is 0.37. This is the second structure function. You see the tail of the Reynolds network correction comes in through the viscosity. And you can just work them all out. There are finitely many for each, you know, finite structure function, and you have to work them out by hand, and that's what John did. This is the first structure function, it's a little more complicated. This is the general term, general structure function, looks like this. This turns out to be the height geometric function, and this coefficient is going to be different for each piece, so you have to work it out, but you can do. So, what can we do with this? Well, once we have the whole theory, we can compare it with the experiment. And we're going to look at the experiments that were done. It's really the experiment that was designed by Crumpler originally, you know, in the variable density interval. Stop me, you know, if I'm going too fast because I'm trying to make it.
So the previous comparison with some experiments that you showed not before this.
Oh, this one, yeah.
Here. So can you say once more? So for to get this theoretical prediction, what do you need? What's the input?
So
do you need an inflow? Do you put in an inflow?
Well, I mean, for homogeneous turbulence and for the experiment that we are looking at, you know, there will be an inflow. But no, the only thing you have to do at this point is that you have to look at this expression here. You have two expectations. One of them is associated with the Brownian motion, the other with the log Poisson processes. That means that you can take expectations. That means you can compute the structure function. That means you can compute the exponents.
But there is also a capital U in the previous expressions inside.
Yes. Yeah. But I mean for homogeneous turbulence.
That's it. Okay.
Well, the gradient of R is going to be zero, and the U itself is going to be a constant.
Mm-hmm.
It's gonna wash out in the structure.
Okay.
At
okay.
For
the exponent.
Well, at least for homogeneous turbulence. But you know, the exponents are always independent of that. Let me think about that for a second. Certainly velocity differences, you're taking the velocity differences of the small flow well, okay. Yeah, if there's non-trivial large flow there, you have to take that into account. You're still going to get this term, you're still going to be able to compute it, and I will give you the exponents, and that's you. Okay. You know, this is not what one did this. I mean, there are other people have computed this, you and Beck, you know, in particular, they argued what the electron should be. What we did originally was to then use this to find the PDFs for the velocity distribution. They turn out to be generalized hyperbolic distributions. But now we're going beyond that. Now we're going to get the Reynolds number dependence. So, how do you do it? Well, you have to look at the number of Reynolds numbers. We look at five Reynolds numbers, you know, Taylor Reynolds numbers going from 110 to 1450. And then we look at five structure functions as well, you know, 2, 3, 4, 6, 8. And we compare the structure functions with the data. You know, you have to do some modification, you have to look at the grid size, you have to look at the system length, which turns out to be the size of the grid, which is used to disturb the flow as it comes into the wind tunnel. But, you know, that is all taken care of. And then you want to fit the data. Now, you notice I had infinitely many coefficients. And I think it was Fermi that said that with four coefficients, you could fit an elephant. So that is definitely too many. But it turns
it's
out.
Curious. The H's have gone away. I've been counting your coefficients. And H's are gone.
The H's.
You know, the ones.
I sort of skipped over that because I didn't want to get too far into the, you know, into the wrong person processes. The H's, they all turn out to be 1/3. And that has to do with the most singular structure being one-dimensional and three-dimensional. You know, it's a computation. They all turn out to be 1/3. Now, I can go into that if you're interested. It turns out that these infinitely many coefficients, they reduce to three coefficients that fit all of these data, all of these Reynolds numbers, and all of these structure functions. Of course, these coefficients are going to depend on the Reynolds numbers. But we go from infinitely many to just three. And they are basically a coefficient describing the C's, another coefficient, you remember this was the centrifugality theorem, another coefficient describing the D's, and then there's a coefficient or a power that describes how fast the Fourier coefficients, the powers of the Fourier coefficients are decaying. And this is important because it's giving you the information about the spatial smoothness of the solution. Now, here's the fit. This is for the smallest, you know, this is on a normal scale, this is on a log-log scale. And the red is the theory, the boxes are fit. You see they're very good for the smallest Reynolds number, and they continue to be good. This is the highest Reynolds number, I'm skipping all the others. And there are some issues with the highest structure function and the highest Reynolds number, but that has to do with the smoothness of the function. But in general, these are very good fits. So you end up with a Crozier model now, which is much improved. In fact, it only has three parameters now, the A's, the B's, and the M. And that, and you can see my H, you know, better request 22. And you can see all the H's. So this is simply, you know, a jump of 1/3,
then the number of units corresponding to each variable. So this now becomes a very simple closure model. And the question is, which may be of interest to this, you know, audience, what else can we do with it? This is what the A's look like as a function of Reynolds number. You know, this is the Reynolds number, you know, going from 100 to 1400. You see that the A is decaying. That's the largest deviation, is that coefficient is decaying with Reynolds number. And the B is very small to begin with, but it increases slowly with Reynolds number. One has to look over the A and one over the A. You know, that depends on the assumption that we made for the coefficients, but you can get these functions, a plot of these functions. So what can I do it? Well, we can compute, use the same method to compute the residual emptiness of the viscosity. And that hopefully is useful. So what you do is that you do the same computation as we did. It's very similar to the second structure function. And I'm simplifying a little here because there should be corrections here, you know, depending on the Reynolds number, and I've skipped that. You know, they can be put in, and we know what they are. So that's what you end up with. You end up with a term which is simply the derivative, you know, where x is now the streamwise direction, kind of ignoring the other directions, but you know, not much is happening there. The streamwise direction, this is a term that's coming from the center in the theorem. This is a term that's coming from the large deviation. And the coefficient here is the influence of the log for some processes. And that's what you get.
My B is almost zero, or which one is? One of them is very small.
Yeah, they, you know, it depends on the Reynolds number. A starts large and becomes small. B starts small and becomes larger. You know, they sort of go in the opposite direction. And then if you integrate this over, you know, your fluid, over your box in the streamwise direction, you get the empty dissipation rate, which turns out to be this quantity. Of course, the A's and the B's depend on the Reynolds number, and I cheated a little.
What is the capital C? Where did that come from?
Yeah, so the capital C was in the structure function, and that is the size of the fluctuation. That basically is the size of the small scale. And that does come in there. So all of these things, you know, those three things, A, B, and C, depend on the Reynolds number, and I cheated a little bit because I should have included the Reynolds number dependence there, but you can still do it and get a little more complicated expression. And I'm hoping that this is useful for people who are looking at the original equation for the large scale flow with very complicated structure. Because if the dissipation is on a small scale is close to being homogeneous, this should be right. And maybe I should stop.
I mean, essentially, what flow is this? Is this homogeneous?
It's homogeneous.
Then why is that not zero?
Well, why is this not zero?
The first part not zero? I mean, you have dvx.
Yeah, so I'm saying, okay, this is the general, so this is general, flow not being homogeneous, but once it becomes homogeneous, I guess. So this becomes zero, and then you can integrate and get, yeah, you're right. This is, in homogeneous flow, this is it.
I
thought
the dx, there is x in the parenthesis.
No, that's the problem.
No, I mean, there's no problem. This is not the homogeneous. This is the general expression in the stream direction. Then we make it homogeneous, this becomes zero, and we can do it.
So you're arguing that for homogeneous turbulence, there is non-zero
viscosity.
Yeah.
Yes.
We
mean, what is the meaning of the viscosity in homogeneous turbulence?
Well, it's a dissipation, you know, it's basically the rate at which the energy is going down to the small scales.
That's not the viscosity. The viscosity is the, well, ratio between the stress tension and the strain tension.
Yeah, I mean, the empty viscosity is this expression here, and it has this form, but then one can compute that to compute.
No, that's not the viscosity. Those are the various of the Reynolds stresses.
Yeah, we had this discussion. I mean, you're thinking about empty viscosity as being simply being the additional viscosity that you get because of turbulence. You're thinking about this constant.
Well, I mean, that's what you usually call the.
This is the residual empty viscosity. It's this term here.
I mean, don't have any stresses.
Yeah.
Not even there. And that is the thing that now becomes that expression there.
Yeah. So this is what's dissipating, you know, the large scale flow, and if you compute the effect of that dissipation over the flow as a whole, then that's what we get.
I mean, I mean, what is that part in there? It's on top. I mean, the part above the you.
All right.
Yeah. It's the expectation. You know. You can think about those in sample average, but it's in my language, it's the expectation.
I mean, in homogeneous flow, right. DDX of anything should be zero. Of any expectation should be zero.
No, the structure functions are not zero.
No, but that's not the derivative with respect to something. Derivative with respect to X. I mean, homogeneous means that the derivatives are zero.
The derivative of the large scale flow.
But
this is not the large scale, this is the small scale flow.
It's an average.
Right. And it's not zero. Because it's not an average over space, it's an average, it's an expectation average. And what you're getting is that you're getting the statistical quantity associated with this stochastic process, and it still is a function of X.
I mean, that's what I don't understand.
why should the small derivative of the small scale flow be zero?
Why should it not be? I mean, if it is homogeneous, everything is in the place invariant to translation, so the statistics should be the same everywhere.
Well, they are. I mean,
they are the same everywhere. Their derivatives are zero.
No, the derivatives of the small scales are not necessarily zero. I mean, look at the structure functions. I mean, the structure functions are the same kind of average, and I mean, they are functions of both.
No, those are different. Those are averages of differences.
You know,
there is a different. I mean, there is a spacing there. They are putting there. They are taking the difference between the velocity here and there.
Yes.
So, but if you are saying. The statistics,
yeah.
you're taking there the derivative for the structure function.
Yeah, but you're saying that the average of U should be zero. It is, yeah.
Of U.
But not of correlations of U.
Don't I mean,
this is a correlation between the different components, and they are not zero.
No, they are not zero, but the derivative with respect to anything, they're zero.
No, they're not zero. I mean, they are this function. I mean, I took the derivative of what the coefficient here is. This is not a function which is zero.
I mean, what does homogeneous mean?
Well, you know, the derivatives of any large scale is going to be to zero, but the small scale, point-wise, is not zero. And the correlations are not going to be zero. I mean, if you were right, then all correlations in homogeneous turbulence will be zero or not.
No, the derivatives of the correlations are zero. The correlations are not zero, of course, but you're taking there the invariance.
You
make an estimate of UI, UJ, that has a value, of course.
Yes.
Which is not zero, but the derivative of that would affect to anything.
What you have is the derivative of the gradient of one component. I mean, if that would be true, then then the residual active viscosity in homogeneous turbulence would be zero, and you would be back to the large scales, you know, the large scale. I mean, if that's true, then there's no coupling between the large scales and the small scales in homogeneous turbulence. I mean, that's not true. There is a dissipation problem.
Of course.
Yeah, and that's what,
I'm
computing, you know.
The dissipation term is the average of the product of the gradient,
right?
The gradient of the product of the
right. But it's not zero. That's what I'm computing. It's not zero.
Is this just a local average?
It's not a local average, in
the sense of a local filter.
Yeah, it's an expectation.
Not a local filter.
Well, I mean, from an LES point of view, that would be true. But Javier, is this term in homogeneous zero or nine?
I don't know which term.
Is the term in homogeneous turbulence zero? It's not. That's what I mean.
You make an average.
But in homogeneous turbulence?
No, I mean, I computed it by making the average of a small scale. And I get something which is not zero and isn't zero. I get the dissipation rate. You know, I mean, everything is trivial in homogeneous turbulence. This is zero. This is zero. You throw this away. So you have ut is equal to the dissipation. You know, and that's what you get.
Dissipation of what? I mean, usually dissipation of energy. I mean, not that. You need to contract that with another u.
Well, you know, it would be the dissipation of the small scales. I mean, basically what it is that it's the energy you have to put in the bin, you know, to maintain the mean flow.
I mean, for that you need to write an equation for energy, you have to multiply that by U. And then you have something that is, in your last term you have a product of U, you have the correlation of U with the gradient of dx, of dr, drdx, okay? That is not zero, that correlation is not zero, but drdx, the mean value of drdx is zero. The correlation is zero, the mean value of any derivative has to be zero.
Well, I mean, what I wrote was precisely the correlation of the gradient with u. That was exactly the term that I picked.
Then there might be something which I am not understanding your formula, because that's not what I see there. I see the gradient of the correlation.
Can I say something? I don't know if we can help, but perhaps I will confuse everybody more. But I think, I mean, you're thinking of homogeneous turbulence, but you made a decomposition in U, large U and small U, which that's a bit.
Maybe my notation was not too. What I should have written is the gradient of small U. Cancelled with U and the average of that.
Even in that case, you can put the U in inside. From continuity.
You need to do the
product of U. The velocity component times the gradient of the Reynolds stresses. That is not zero.
The secretary said there's a great deal of nervousness because people think Cook is going to disappear.
Let me just find it. Okay, I take your point.